Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. John Pfeffer is our guest this time. He's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the International Relations Center, part of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also author of the 2003 book North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy and the Korean Peninsula, out from Seven Stories Press. John Pfeffer is uniquely qualified to assess U.S. policies towards North Korea. He was a Pan-Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and taught a graduate-level course in international conflict at Sung Kung Ho University in Seoul. In addition to North Korea, South Korea, John Pfeffer is also author of the book Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11. You will find his most recent articles online at fpif.org, Foreign Policy in Focus. They include Caught in the Muddle, Round 2 of Bush versus North Korea, and in July, North Korea Fireworks, as well as the piece Negotiating Space with North Korea, which just appeared in the Boston Globe. John Pfeffer, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Your July 6th piece, Negotiating Space with North Korea. Let's start there, because I don't think a lot of listeners are aware of the conversation going on right now about the satellite control, about Star Wars, the missile programs, and how important those all are in terms of the negotiative process and the other processes going on where North Korea is concerned.
North Korea has been developing a nuclear program, a missile program, and a satellite program, and sometimes they are conflated, and we have difficulties distinguishing between, for instance, the missile program and a satellite program. But North Korea has several kind of objectives with these programs. There's a major kind of deterrent objective. In other words, North Korea wants to prevent any kind of attack against it. It doesn't want to fall into the same category that Afghanistan and Iraq have fallen into. They want to prevent any kind of attack, and they believe that nuclear capability and long-range missiles will serve as a deterrent against attack. But there's also a kind of economic factor here. North Korea has sold some of its short-range missiles, so it is a lucrative industry for them. But they would also like to have a satellite. They would like to have a satellite industry, if possible, because they look around at their neighboring countries. They look at China, at Japan, at South Korea, and these countries have very vital satellite programs. They would like as well to have a North Korean satellite in orbit. And back in 1999-2000, when the Clinton administration was trying to negotiate with North Korea in order to get rid of its missile program, one of the offers on the table was for the United States to actually launch a satellite for North Korea, to put a satellite into orbit for North Korea, and in exchange, North Korea would retire its missile program.
I would imagine that that set various corporations wondering if they would be the ones to profit or not from that kind of a negotiative process.
Yes, there's definitely a corporate interest. You know, the satellite industry has become a huge industry, over $100 billion recently. And up until now, there hasn't been that much corporate interest in North Korea, unlike China, for instance, where corporations have invested a huge amount of money into the Chinese economy. North Korean economy, it's not in particularly good shape. The size of the North Korean population, it's about 23 million people. It's not all that large, I mean, compared to, say, 1.3 billion people in China. So it's not a huge market for foreign goods. So there hasn't been a lot of interest and investment into North Korea. So this satellite possibility could be, sometime in the future, one point of interest on the part of the business community in North Korea.
Now, where is the North getting this technology and the rockets and so on that they have been sort of saber-rattling with, really, ever since George Bush took office?
Part of it is from their contacts around the world. They profited a great deal from their military cooperation with Russia, with the Soviet Union, prior to the Soviet Union's collapse. They have, it seems, worked with other countries to develop their capabilities a little more. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that North Korean technology itself is actually quite sophisticated. For the last 50 years, they've developed some quite interesting technological advances. They have a very large engineering sector. They, up until, again, recently, they had a very vital manufacturing sector. So it's not inconceivable that North Korea actually has made a number of advances simply by itself. So part of it is reverse engineering. In other words, they take something from outside. They take a piece of technology from outside of North Korea. They take it apart. They learn how it works, and then they reproduce it. That would be reverse engineering. But some of it is really indigenous advances in technology of their own.
How is North Korea doing in terms of economic stability, and to what degree is its defense industry sort of key there?
Mm-hmm. The real problem that North Korea faced in the 1980s was that it wasn't importing a lot of new technologies, wasn't getting very much foreign capital. Whatever kind of advances that it was able to make on its own only went so far, because it wasn't really exposed to the latest cutting-edge technologies that were on the global market. So that was a problem for its economy. And its economy started to really decline from the late 1970s through the 1980s into the 1990s. The problems really came to a head in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union and China changed their economic relationship with North Korea. Previously, those two countries provided North Korea with very cheap energy. And after 1990, 1991, they switched to hard currency so that North Korea actually had to pay essentially world prices for its energy. And that had a devastating effect on the North Korean manufacturing sector. And it also had a devastating effect on North Korea's agricultural sector, because North Korea's agriculture is heavily dependent on energy inputs. But since the year 2000, the North Korean economy has very, very slowly reconstituted itself. And it's not exactly a vibrant economy by any stretch of the imagination. But last year, the GNP did show modest increase. They had a pretty good harvest. And there have also been some rather dramatic economic reforms in wages and prices, but also in the permission for private enterprise to take root in North Korea. So it's not just a state sector any longer. You have a somewhat more varied economy. The government announced several years ago a military first policy, and that was designed to put emphasis on the defense of the country, on the building of armaments to defend the country. And so the defense sector plays a very strong role in the country. The question, however, is to what degree has the defense sector accepted economic reform, and to what degree has the defense sector actually gotten a stake in economic reform? In China, the military actually became quite involved in the dramatic economic changes in the 1980s and 1990s. So therefore, the military supported the economic changes. They did quite well with their enterprises. North Korea, it's unclear how much the North Korean military has taken advantage of these economic reforms to set up their own institutions, their own entrepreneurial ventures.
John Pfeffer, you have also prepared another report for Foreign Policy in Focus. This came out before the 4th of July, but your title was interesting, North Korea Fireworks. And those first two paragraphs, let's just start there, because they're fascinating and also somewhat frightening, where we have to turn to Dick Cheney for someone with a calmer head to prevail in terms of a preemptive attack against the North.
Yes. Well, there was a proposal made in the Washington Post by William Perry and Ashton Carter. And William Perry was the architect of Bill Clinton's engagement policy, 1999-2000, with North Korea. And he did kind of an about-face. He published an op-ed saying that we shouldn't wait for North Korea to develop its missile capabilities. We should launch a preemptive attack against this launch facility and take it out. And the Bush administration, which, you know, has not been a big friend of North Korea. Of course, George Bush identified North Korea as one of the members of the Axis of Evil, was very unenthusiastic about that proposal. And Dick Cheney in particular, who really has taken the hardest line against North Korea, said we have to let diplomacy work in this situation as much as possible. We shouldn't go ahead with these plans for a preemptive strike. I think this is for two reasons. One, you know, it's very frustrating to negotiate with North Korea. You know, they are in a very poor position, and they are willing basically to engage in all sorts of acts of brinksmanship in order to compensate for their very weak position. It's a weak position economically, and it's a weak position militarily as well. So I can understand why William Perry and Ashton Carter, who were involved in a long series of negotiations, have become frustrated with dealing with North Korea. On the other hand, and this is what explains the Bush administration's reaction, there is a very great acknowledgement within the Pentagon and within the U.S. government more generally about the consequences of attack on North Korea, that if the United States were to launch a preemptive strike, that North Korea would respond. It would respond with an artillery attack against Seoul, the capital of South Korea. It might as well attack U.S. positions, U.S. troops in Japan. The Pentagon has estimated that within 90 days of a conflict breaking out in the Korean Peninsula, several hundred thousand people would die. And that is a reality that the Pentagon has right in front of it. It makes it very reluctant to support any kind of attack against North Korea that could lead to those consequences.
And just as a kind of sidebar question, really, doesn't South Korea still have a strong presence in Iraq on behalf of the coalition?
This was a major point of contention between the United States and South Korea because the political forces that brought Noh Moo-hyun, the current South Korean president, into office were very reluctant to support U.S. military operations overseas. And Noh Moo-hyun himself expressed many reservations against U.S. operations overseas. And so it took quite a lot of arm twisting to get South Korea to agree to its commitments. And there's still a great deal of pressure within South Korea to withdraw all South Korean troops from Iraq.
This is a question I've just been longing to ask someone. Why, in advance of this missile test by North Korea, was George W. Bush at Graceland with the head of Japan? I mean, one would think that they would have wanted to have had a show of strength.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we saw karaoke.
This is a good example of the close relationship between George Bush and Junichiro Koizumi, the Prime Minister of Japan. The two of them have emerged as perhaps the closest allies in recent years, closer in some sense than any European ally, England included, because since 1998, especially, Japan has moved in a much more aggressive military direction, abandoning its earlier commitment to pacifism, abandoning its earlier commitment to entirely defensive military posture, and supporting very strongly the Bush administration's objectives in East Asia, which meant containment of North Korea and containment of China, and broadly endorsing Bush administration policies elsewhere in the world, including wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So Koizumi has really emerged as the closest friend for George Bush. Everyone says that George Bush responds to people on a very personal level, and I think he responds to Koizumi on a personal level. I think going to Graceland is really a symbol of their personal relationship as much as an alliance relationship.
So we saw then this strange, surreal state where there was all of this heavy rhetoric, and Washington, not known usually at this point under this administration for calm, suggests that it really isn't that much of a threat. Then we come to find out that actually one of these Taepodong long-range rockets was actually had a trajectory of Hawaii. It just all seemed so bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are several reasons why I think the Bush administration kind of responded in a temperate manner, almost a dismissive manner. One is because the Bush administration faces, you know, a great number of challenges elsewhere in the world. Obviously, continuing war in Iraq, escalating violence in Afghanistan, problems in Sudan and Somalia, and frankly speaking, the administration knows it can't really handle another major crisis unless, you know, it's pushed into it by circumstances. But it will not willingly, take on North Korea at this point when it's basically tied down elsewhere in the world. The second major reason would be because the Bush administration knows that the North Korean military fundamentally does not pose a threat. Let's take the missile program. Yes, it launched a Taepodong 2 missile, but it didn't go very far. And the last one it launched in 1998 didn't go where it was supposed to go either. Most military analysts say that North Korea wouldn't have any type of military threat with its missile program for another at least 10 years. So its missile program is not much of a threat. I believe that the Bush administration has a realistic understanding of North Korea's nuclear potential as well. Yes, North Korea undoubtedly has nuclear material. Has it weaponized that material? Probably not. It probably does not have the miniaturization technology capable of producing warheads that it could then put on missiles. And then third, its army. It has the fifth largest standing army in the world, but we're talking about an army that is severely undernourished. We're talking about hardware which is outdated, which it doesn't have the new parts to fix. Talking about an army that gets very little training because there simply isn't the resources to train them. I mean, the Air Force pilots don't have enough fuel to go out on more than one training mission a year, which is simply not enough to have a competent Air Force. So I think the Bush administration recognizes that, fundamentally speaking, North Korea talks a lot in a threatening manner, but probably does not have the means to back up its threats. Now, the two things about Japan, which I think are very important, Japan said not only that it would respond to a North Korean attack, but very recently it has said that it would even consider a preemptive attack against North Korea. And this really is quite a departure from Japan's last 60 years of foreign and military policy. The idea that Japan would actually endorse preemptive attacks against North Korea is really quite startling. The second is that we have to remember that Japan, by most estimates, could have a nuclear arsenal within half a year. Right now, of course, Japan is pledged to be a non-nuclear nation. However, it has a huge amount of plutonium, and it has the technology to weaponize that plutonium so that within 6 months, it would have a nuclear arsenal and become part of the nuclear club. So this is a very, very threatening, as far as I'm concerned, very threatening development.
Before we talk about our missile defense system, I really want to ask about Valiant Shield, because you describe what was going on there as something of a provocation where Pyongyang was concerned. Just talk about the various countries, Japan, South Korea, the U.S., testing weapons together and what that meant to the North.
North Korea feels surrounded. Doesn't have a lot of allies these days with the collapse of the Soviet Union, collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. It can count on some support from China, but not consistent support necessarily. So it feels surrounded. And whenever the United States, Japan, and South Korea coordinate their policies, particularly their military policies, this is a sign, once again, to North Korea that it has very few friends in the world and that in its own neighborhood it is surrounded. But the real challenge about Valiant Shield, military exercises that took place at the end of June in the Pacific region, was that China was invited as an observer. Now, from our point of view here in the United States, well, that seems like a great confidence-building mechanism. You know, there's been a lot of problems in U.S.-Chinese relations and certainly a lot of problems between China and Japan. This is good that China's there observing, that it can actually have high-level contacts between its military officers. So from our point of view, that's a good thing. From North Korea's point of view, it's even worse, because at least it, up until recently, it could count on some support from China, and now it sees China actually participating in the same exercises that it found so threatening in the past. So these recent exercises, I think, really contributed to North Korea's decision to fire these missiles, to say, hey, remember us, we're here, you can't take us for granted any longer.
The discussion has also turned at times to whether or not the U.S. has taken a military strike against the North off the table, and the consensus is that they have not. But then there have been some who have argued that preemption doctrine would probably not be used here. But let's turn finally to what you have said about Kim Jong-il and the whole issue of our missile defense program. To what extent should we see this latest standoff as political in America and the North, and to what extent should we see it as a real military process that the White House is running?
Well, let's start off with North Korea. I mean, clearly the missile launches were part of a domestic political debate within the country, with, you know, some people saying that they shouldn't set it off and the military wanting to set it off. And the reason that I believe this debate was taking place is because they interviewed a North Korean official immediately after the launch, and he said, we diplomats don't really know what's going on militarily inside the country, which is quite a dramatic admission coming from a North Korean official. And I think it suggests that there's quite a deep divide between the military in North Korea, which wants to test its toys and which wants to demonstrate that it has a deterrent capability, and the diplomatic corps, which is desperate to get some kind of an agreement with the powerful countries of the world. So the missile launch clearly was Kim Jong-il saying to the military, look, I'm going forward with a number of economic reforms, I'm trying some diplomatic initiatives, especially with South Korea, but I haven't forgotten you. Don't worry, I take your interests at heart. We still abide by the military first doctrine. I will launch these missiles to prove that. So that's the kind of political situation inside North Korea. Here in the United States, yes, we've justified our missile defense program in large part on the basis of threats coming from countries like North Korea. And it's been much easier to push through funding in Congress by saying, look, these are clear and present dangers, and we need to put money into a system which, well, frankly, a lot of scientists have said won't work. And those scientists have been able to point at the tests that we've done over the last 5 years or so and say, look, you know, the tests demonstrate that even though we've put in billions and billions of dollars, we still can't hit a bullet with a bullet. That was the objective of this program as set forth by the Reagan administration when it first began Star Wars. We still can't do it. It would have been a great embarrassment if the North Korean missile, the Taepodong 2, had not failed within a few minutes of flight and had gone off into the stratosphere, and we had tried to shoot it down with missile defense and failed. It would have been a very, very clear case of our missile defense system not working. So we, in some sense, were lucky that it failed. The administration can say, well, this Taepodong missile demonstrates once again that we need to put a lot of effort into this program because, again, the missile launch demonstrates that they are a clear and present danger. If not the Taepodong 2, the long-range missile, then the other six missiles, which were short-range missiles, those were successful, and they demonstrate that North Korea has a robust short-range missile program. And, of course, as a result of that, we have sent anti-missile defenses to Japan, and so Japan will be deploying those very shortly. So it facilitated that move in the U.S.-Japanese alliance, military alliance.
We could say, too, that this launch of the Taepodong missile really split the Republican Party even more than the Iraq War did, right? Because you describe the process where Kurt Weldon, a hawkish Republican from the House Armed Services Committee, and Lisa Murkowski, Republican senator from Alaska, Bush supporter, and then Richard Lugar, all uneasy and disillusioned with this president.
Yes, they're disillusioned with North Korea policy specifically. They've looked at the last 6 years of U.S.-North Korean relations, and they've seen what has happened. North Korea has what was once a frozen nuclear program. North Korea has unfrozen it, has reprocessed who knows how much nuclear material, has moved forward on missile development. It moved away from its self-imposed moratorium on missile launches. And the Bush administration has done nothing. It has insisted on multilateral negotiations, which haven't produced really anything, and it has refused to talk bilaterally with North Korea, which has been one of North Korea's demands. It has also, in the multilateral negotiations, basically said to North Korea, you have to give up your single bargaining chip before we'll even consider talking about what we will give you in return. And North Korea, of course, is not interested in giving up its single bargaining chip, its nuclear program, and so the multilateral talks haven't gone anywhere. So there has been dissension within the Republican Party. The Republicans are, I think, concerned that the Bush administration's foreign policy has not yielded too much successes anywhere in the world, but in particular in North Korea, it's so clearly a failure that this will become an election issue at the very least. At the very worst, it will become an international crisis. I think, for instance, Kurt Weldon is concerned about what might happen if North Korean government will collapse. Now, you and I might say, well, it's a dictatorship. The sooner it collapses, the better. You know, it would be great if a democratic movement or government would replace Kim Jong-il. Well, there frankly is no democratic movement that is on the horizon in North Korea. There is no political opposition in the country. So it doesn't look as though there will be anything that would replace a collapsed regime. And if the regime does collapse, well, then what does happen to all this nuclear material? You know, people have compared North Korea to a Walmart. They've said North Korea is selling all sorts of military hardware, and it's very possible that it will sell nuclear material as well in the future. My major concern is not that North Korea is running a Walmart, but that it will actually collapse and that the doors of North Korea will be open and anybody can walk in and take whatever they want. And I think that's a concern as well for anybody who is looking at military security issues, U.S. national security issues, issues which these Republicans are very concerned about.
We hear a lot about these six-party talks that the White House is insisting upon. Why? Why not meet with the North privately in the bilateral talks that Kim Jong-il wants to have?
You could take the most cynical position on this and say that the U.S. government fundamentally doesn't want an agreement with North Korea, that the Bush administration has spent a lot of time deriding the agreed framework of 1994, which, of course, was the handiwork of the Clinton administration. And it doesn't want to be caught in a similar kind of negotiating process and agreement with North Korea, that it will be viewed as appeasing North Korea. And in fact, that's what it accused the Clinton administration of doing when various architects of the Bush policy were, at that point, either in Congress or critics of the Clinton administration. So the cynical view, again, is that if you kind of create this very, very complicated six-party negotiation structure, that it will be virtually impossible to negotiate any agreement, and that North Korea itself, because it has argued for bilateral discussions, will refuse to proceed with negotiations in the six-party format. Less cynical view is that U.S. government recognizes, as we all do, that this issue of North Korea's nuclear program is not simply a bilateral issue, that of course, if North Korea develops nuclear weapons, this is an issue that affects the entire region, and that the region should have input on any kind of negotiations to end that program. And I think fundamentally that is true. It should, to a certain extent, be a regional discussion. The question is not whether it should be regional or bilateral. The question is what should be the mix. And one can set up a structure in which there are six-party discussions on this question, and there are bilateral discussions between the United States and North Korea. One does not preclude the other. One does preclude the other when the Bush administration refuses to sit down face-to-face with North Korea. So those are two different ways of looking at the six-party talks.
Thanks for joining us on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much.
John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, online at fpif.org, where you will find his books and articles on North Korea and other subjects. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion within the new CAFE discussion group.